Good morning, Your Honors. Luke Cederberg, number 43992, on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant, Mary Brennan. Your Honors, this case concerns a motor vehicle collision in which the defendant and appellee, Elizabeth Gorham, took a left turn out of a driveway onto a roadway and a collision occurred. At trial, the jury found over $73,000 in damages, but they also found Ms. Brennan 50% negligent and Ms. Gorham 50% negligent, thus resulting in no recovery for Ms. Brennan. There were two issues at the trial that denied Ms. Brennan a fair trial. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the issuance of jury instruction number 16, which is the rear-end presumption of negligence instruction. It's based off civil jury instruction 11-12. And that issuing that instruction simply did not comport with the facts of this case. If we were to issue that instruction in this case, then that instruction should be given in every case where there is any rear-end impact to a vehicle.
Let me ask you, Mr. Cederberg, if I can. I mean, I do understand your argument. I mean, essentially, this was an intersectional collision, you know, not really a rear-ender. Let me ask you, why is there prejudice here? Because the instruction said something effective, if you find that there's a rear-end collision, then you apply the presumption. How do we have prejudice when the jury first needs to even find if there was a rear-end collision?
Well, so the instruction is really a truncated version of the law, and in there it says that if there's a rear-end impact, and so it's suggesting to the jury that if there's damage to the rear of the vehicle, then they had to presume the plaintiff negligent. And there was damage to the rear of the vehicle. Nobody's disputing that.
Why does it suggest that if there was any damage? I think you argued this issue that this was just an intersectional collision. Why can't we assume the jury would have listened to your argument and made a decision if there was a rear end argument, you know, resolve the dispute among the parties as to whether this was a rear end collision or not?
Well, Your Honor, it's suggesting the idea to the jury that the plaintiff should be presumed negligent. And it's just giving a burden to the plaintiff to overcome that isn't there at law. It's another obstacle for the plaintiff to overcome, and that is prejudice. It renders the risk of confusing the jury. Because the other instructions we had were sufficient for the parties' theories of the case. We had two theories of the case. We had Ms. Brennan's theory of the case was Ms. Gorham's left-hand turn caused the collision. And Ms. Gorham's theory of the case was Ms. Brennan negligently changed lanes at the last moment, and that caused the collision. Neither of those has to do with a following too closely tailgating situation. We already had the instructions on that were sufficient for those. We had the look but don't see instruction, and we had the failure to keep a proper lookout. So by introducing this other idea about if it's rear-end impact and you have to get a new presumption of negligence, I think that renders a huge risk of confusing the jury. And that's particularly important in this case, where it was as close as they come. And you don't have to take my word for it. The jury found 50-50 on liability. So if that instruction confused the jury by just 1% against Ms. Brennan, that denied her recovery. The cases in this area are very clear that more is required to issue this instruction than just the rear-end impact. Bettner v. Boring and the cases it cites, largely out of Missouri, talk about when to issue this instruction, and they repeatedly use language like overtake, one car traveling behind the other for some distance, following too closely. So in essence, this really is a rear-end instruction, or a tailgating instruction. And no version of the facts here suggested tailgating. If you look at the case of Todd v. Presley, it's out of Missouri, and it's cited with approval by Bettner v. Boring, the facts of that case are highly similar to this one. In that case, a car took a left turn, it traveled 75 to 100 feet, and then the collision occurred. And the case refused to issue the instruction in that case, saying it was an intersectional collision. Well, here we don't have 75 to 100 feet. If we believe Ms. Gorham's testimony, which was refuted by her own expert, but even if we believe exactly what she said she completed her turn and traveled at most one car length. One car length. So to apply that instruction here is essentially saying that any time a driver cuts another driver off in traffic, well, as long as the other driver hits him in the rear, then the other driver is presumed to be negligent.
In a situation, Mr. Cederberg, where the following vehicle, your client's car, was properly in its lane for some period of travel, I would absolutely agree with you. But here there's a question of fact as to whether she was indeed in that left eastbound lane consistently, or whether she turned from the right lane and made a lane change. So, I mean, when we're looking at the facts to determine whether the instruction should be given, I'm going back to Judge Gabriel's question, because the jury wasn't told it is a rear-end collision. It was told if you find it was a rear-end collision, then there's a presumption. So, given the facts that it was unclear from both parties' versions of the facts, why is it an abuse of discretion for the trial court to give an instruction that clearly stated the law correctly?
It's an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because under Clement v. Davies, issuing instruction that's not warranted by competent evidence is an abuse of discretion. And here, you're right, there was a dispute over whether Ms. Brennan changed lanes or not. That dispute had nothing to do with a rear-end collision.
Why is that? I'm not following that.
So, the cases on this issue are suggesting that this instruction goes with a situation that results out of a tailgate, out of somebody's following too closely. And the defendant, in their version of what happened, they didn't say, oh, Ms. Brennan was tailgating our client. They said Ms. Brennan changed lanes at the last moment. And we have instructions to deal with that situation, and those instructions were given. It was, look, if Ms. Brennan looked and didn't see, or if Ms. Brennan failed to keep a proper lookout when she changed lanes, those apply to the facts of this case. So introducing this other instruction that did not apply to the facts was merely confusing to the jury. The second issue I would like to discuss is, and we believe that abusing this discretion in issuing this instruction warrants a new trial on liability. The second issue I'd like to discuss is comments made by the court that were damaging to the plaintiff's credibility and stoked an anti-plaintiff bias. I don't want to misquote the court, so I want to get exactly what the court said in the presence of the jury. Quote, we all know, I think intuitively, that some people who are in litigation malinger in order to magnify their damages. In other words, without getting into the technical term, psychologically malingering, they're faking it, trying to get the gain of more money.
So, Mr. Cederberg, even if I were to agree with you that that's improper, I noticed that you didn't lodge a contemporaneous objection at the time. Can you address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. So we did not object right away. I think the context of why the court, how we got here is important to that. There have just been repeated objections and a bench conference, and I think these comments may have come out of the judge's frustration with trying to move it along. So we were afraid by objecting at that moment, not only were we highlighting those comments even more for the jury to sit there and think about, but we might further aggravate the judge and provoke some additional comments. I would also say that we did object as soon as the jury was excused.
Well, so let me ask you about that, Mr. Cederberg. And I have concerns about these comments, and I understand what you said about you made a strategic call to object as soon as the jury was excused. My problem is whether you actually objected to these comments. You said, you know, we object to the comments the court made. The court clearly construed it to refer to remarks on the loss of enjoyment of life, but I had no idea what he was talking about. Opposing counsel said, what are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking about, and you refused to tell him. You said the judge knows. How did that preserve the objection you're making now?
Well, Your Honor, there was only, unfortunately, only one monologue from the judge during that preceding testimony. We objected to his comments made during Dr. Matthews' testimony. The judge only made one, you know, comment. It was a three-paragraph long comment, but it was only one comment.
But he said something about loss of enjoyment of life. That has nothing to do with this comment about malingering that I can see. Why don't you just, you know, your opposing counsel asked you, what was the issue? Can you be more clear? And you refused to tell them. And I have concerns about that.
Yes. Well, again, we weren't trying to shove the judge's face in it. We weren't trying to humiliate him. He'd only made one series of comments, you know, one continuous comment. When we made that objection, he clearly knew what we were talking about from his body language.
But that's the point. We have to look at the record. What you say he clearly knew what you were talking about, but he referred to something that appears to me to be something different. And you know, we're appellate judges. We got to look at a cold record, and it is the duty of counsel to make a clear objection. And I guess I'm still not hearing why you think that was sufficient to preserve the objection. Is it that, you know, your objection preserves an objection to every single statement the judge made in that monologue? I'm concerned how that's enough.
As far as the loss of enjoyment of life portion, I think your concern there kind of demonstrates how far off base the comments were. But this, taken as a whole, the entire monologue, it was referring to, he was trying to instruct a witness that, hey, you can testify about loss of enjoyment of life. That was the message. And yes, we do, I'm highlighting the comments that are specifically the most damaging to the plaintiff, but we did object to the entire comments. Later on in there, he said, you know, maybe she's not a great driver. So the entire thing was objectionable. That was the only comment he made. I think based on that, we can...
Well, counsel, when you say you object in general, so not only did you specifically tell the court what it was you were objecting, but you didn't ask for a remedy that you did in the briefs either, did you? You didn't ask for a new trial until you got in front of this court. So how could the court even consider that if it wasn't in front of it?
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe two things on that matter. First of all, there was no remedy. The bell should not be unrung at that point. The judge had made his comments saying, hey, sometimes plaintiffs are lying. There's really nothing we could overcome with that.
Well, in the brief proposed a remedy, it proposed a new trial.
Well, yes, we were four days into the trial at this point, and to ask for a new trial at that point we're thinking, you know, we'll see how it comes out, because to propose a new trial at that point, we just wasted 4 days of the court's time. We're, you know, wasting judicial resources. We're wasting both sides spending a significant amount of experts. So as a practical matter, it really did not make sense to be asking for a new trial right at that moment.
We have some case law, Mr. Cederberg, that I think says that if you make a contemporaneous objection, it gives the court the opportunity to cure any prejudice that may have resulted from its comments. What you're arguing seems to be contrary to that law.
Well, I've been thinking, honestly, since these comments were made, what remedy could have been given that would have undone it. And aside from a new trial on liability, I cannot think of what the court could have done to make the jury unhear those statements.
Well, couldn't the court have said, I made an erroneous statement. I said something I shouldn't have said. It's inappropriate. It's improper. Members of the jury, you're to disregard what I said. What's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, we did. I mean, I think our objection was contemporaneous enough in the sense that the court still had an opportunity to do that.
Did you ask him to?
No, Your Honor, we did not. We think these comments warrant a new trial on liability. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please this court. My name is Tom Seaman. My registration number is 4172. I'm practicing with Frank Patterson and Associates, and we represent the defendant appellee Elizabeth Gorham. With regard to and taking the issues in the order in which Mr. Cederberg presented them to the court, with regard to the presumption of negligence, well, one of the things I want to make sure you understand, and Judge Gabriel, you indicated that your sense was that this was an intersection collision. It actually happened mid-block. My client was pulled out of a post office at Holly and Evans, and the traffic sort of parted the way so she could make that maneuver through a long line of cars that were backed up at, I think it's Holly Street. So she negotiates that entry onto Evans. She wants to go east on Evans, and there's a center lane that is actually there and marked for left turns from cars going in either direction. She got into that lane knowing that she was going to have to then move over one more lane to get into the left eastbound lane. And the evidence that the jury had before it is that she did made that maneuver carefully, looked for traffic that was coming in the lane that she was about to enter, saw none, and then I think she completed the lane change into the through lane and had established a position, albeit not for very long, but she had made that lane change into the left through lane, and she got struck from behind. And I really don't think there's any dispute over the fact that this was a rear-end type collision. There were photographs, there was the defendant's own testimony, the accident reconstruction engineer indicated that and then pointed it out on the photographs.
Well, let me ask about that, Mr. Seaman, and I didn't mean to mislead. I was using the term your colleague here had used on intersectional. I think I understood the facts. But what the evidence that the plaintiff here kind of hit your client on an angle? I mean, it wasn't your traditional kind of she's following. One car makes the left turn, the defendant's car makes the left turn. From your theory, I guess the plaintiff's car is changing lanes, but kind of hadn't even gotten in that lane and clips kind of a corner of the car.
There's no question that the plaintiff's vehicle, which I think the jury could find and probably did find that she had been in the right lane, was changing lanes into that left lane. And there's no question that there was some angular orientation by the plaintiff's vehicle. But I don't think you have to have a flush, you know, front on back, rear end collision for the instruction to be given. Keeping in mind that one of as the court pointed out, the instruction itself indicates that it's up to the jury to decide if this was a rear end collision, so whether there was any presumption at all. The way it was phrased by the trial court is that if you find by preponderance the evidence that the driver hit another vehicle in the rear while both vehicles were facing in the same direction. Now, maybe you could argue in terms of your question that the plaintiff's vehicle wasn't facing in the same direction because she was at a slight angle.
Well, I was trying to get to, you know, not playing a game with you, how does this fit within Bettner? I read your brief and it felt like just because they were, and I understand it was some contact in the rear, I get that. Bettner specifically says that's not enough, there have to be some other things. And I wasn't sure what facts support the other things Bettner requires.
Well, I really think that the argument by Mr. Cederberg, both in the brief and here today, is focusing on whether or not my client had established a position traveling eastbound in that left through lane. And I don't think it's so much whether or not the plaintiff was still completing her lane change or had completed it or whether her vehicle was angled slightly toward the north or whether she was facing straight east at the time of impact. The question really is, was the defendant's vehicle, which had made this lane change, have a position established proceeding eastbound in that left through lane? And if the impact then comes from her rear, I think the instruction is given with the understanding and the wording of the instruction that the jury can rejected. And all the arguments that the plaintiffs have made with regard to whether Ms. Gorham made a safe lane change into that lane, whether she should have pulled out of the post office in the first place, all of that was argued in closing, and the jury found that there was negligence on the part of both parties. So they did not exonerate my client completely in terms of her actions. What they did is they looked at both parties to this accident with a proper instruction on comparative negligence and made the finding that they did.
Well, how do you distinguish Bettner then? I mean, the court in Bettner, Supreme Court, said, you know, we don't perceive the defendant to have been a following motorist or an overtaking vehicle. Bettner was not traveling directly behind Loring. The vehicles were not in relatively close proximity. We have the close proximity here. How do we get those facts here?
I don't think Bettner is completely an exclusive list of circumstances or situation in which the presumption would apply. I think the court gave some examples of situations where it would clearly apply. But I still think that there is enough leeway that, particularly when you instruct the jury that it's up to them to determine whether this is a rear-end collision or not. Given the instruction, and there was evidence, and I think I've summarized it in terms of the position of both vehicles and whether the plaintiff had completed the lane change or was in, you know, nearly completed or whatever, I don't think it is a salient fact that, that determines whether or not the instruction should be given at all. I think there was sufficient evidence from which the jury could, first of all, make the finding that this was a rear-end collision, and with the opportunity by plaintiffs to argue otherwise. Then the instruction says the law presumes that the driver was negligent, but then concludes by stating, however, the presumption is rebuttable. So it leaves it in the hands of the jury to decide under this instruction whether it applies at all, and then further decide whether there's rebutting evidence that would, you know, basically negate the instruction. With regard to the remarks by the trial judge, I've heard the court's question, and I guess what I would emphasize is something that has already been brought up, and that is the lack of any contemporaneous objection that was made at the time of the remarks. Now, Mr. Cederberg says that, well, if they had stood up and objected in front of the jury, that it would have simply highlighted it, they didn't want to humiliate the judge. Judge Stern has been on the bench a long time. He's not easily humiliated. And I think they could have asked to approach the bench and without, you know, stating this in front of the jury or out loud in front of the jury, pointed out to the judge that his remarks and its use of the word, for example, malingering or, and that sort of thing, was sort of over the top, and that they were objecting to that specific remark. It would have been fresh in his mind. They would have told him exactly what they were objecting to, and he would have had an opportunity to give some type of curative instruction. Now, I did instruct the jury at the end of the case, and instruction number three is a pattern instruction that says that remarks of counsel that were not made to the jury are not evidence and shouldn't be considered by, for any purpose.
So I think you mean the court.
Or by the court, I'm sorry. That same instruction says remarks of counsel, right. But in this case we're talking about the court. And there's a presumption that the jury followed that instruction.
But there's case law that says sometimes you can't, that instruction's not good enough if the court's comments are so over the top.
I agree with that. And that's the reason that I think that Judge Stern deserved an opportunity to consider what their objection was. And they could even suggest what they wanted him to do about it in terms of a remedy. And that wasn't done. And when they did bring it up, at the end of the day, it was clear from Judge Stern's response that he didn't really understand what they were specifically addressing, and I had no idea what they were talking about, and that's the reason for my question to counsel, and rather than saying, you know, we're talking about this remark and we think it's improper, then I would have had an opportunity to discuss this with the judge and say, Judge, I agree that we need some sort of curative instruction just to make sure there's not any misunderstanding or prejudice caused by those remarks. They made the briefest and most non-specific objections possible at that point in time, and then we moved on. And it took me, Mr. Cederberg has argued here today that nothing short of a new trial would be an adequate remedy. Well, that's called motion for mistrial. If you're in the midst of a trial and something happens and you think it's egregious enough for the court to declare a mistrial, you have to ask for a mistrial. It may not happen, but at least then you've made your record with regard to the remedy that you think is the only adequate remedy, and the court can consider that and either grant a mistrial or deny it, and we'd be here arguing that decision rather than whether there was an adequate objection.
Mr. Seaman, is it possible to consider plain error in the civil context in a situation like this where in a personal injury case, the trial judge is talking about psychologically malingering, they're faking it, trying to get the gain of more money. Is that something that we could even consider as an appellate court?
I don't think it rises to the level of plain error. I tend to agree that, you know, I was surprised by the remarks, but you have to understand, and I think we explained this in our brief, the context in which they were made. Judge Stern was trying to move the case along. We had a new expert on the stand. She was a psychiatrist. there were two accidents that the plaintiff was involved in. She had analyzed or evaluated the plaintiff with regard to both. The judge was going to limit her to only the first accident that we were trying to this jury. So we had a couple of trips to the bench and arguments, and the judge was asked to look at her report. Plaintiff's counsel wanted to limit her strictly to her report, not allow her to stray from that. I understand that. I returned to the podium, Judge Stern said, you know, let me explain to you what the boundaries are here. And he's clearly talking to her, and he's using hypothetical languages to, you know, we all know that there are plaintiffs that malinger or exaggerate their symptoms. He's not saying this plaintiff. He also made the comment that, you know, you might hold the opinion that because of anxiety issues, she's a bad driver, but you haven't stated that anywhere in any report. You're not going to testify about it here.
The interesting thing on that, Mr. Seaman, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he made that same comment about this isn't in your report about the malingering comment. I don't understand how the malingering comment has anything to do with the limitation on this expert's testimony. And, you know, judges get angry sometimes, I get it. But maybe you can help me understand.
I've tried a lot of cases in front of Judge Stern. I think he's a great judge. I, despite that experience, I can't get inside of his head. And I really don't know why he made the comment he made, or why, like he said, in one case he tied the limiting instruction to the doctor's report, and the other he appeared to just go off on a tangent. But I think he was on a tangent. And I think I don't think the jury tied that to anything that they heard in the trial. And keep in mind that the malingering comment really went to the issue of damages. I mean, if the jury had come back and found liability, let's say they apportioned negligence 60-40 in favor of the plaintiff, but had returned a low dollar damage amount, then I think the plaintiffs would have an argument that the judge poisoned the well or tainted this jury by suggesting to him that her damages were not all that significant and that she was faking it. The decision by the jury was a liability decision. They found equal negligence on the part of the parties. They had an instruction telling them exactly what the effect of those findings were, the stock instruction on the effect of comparative negligence findings. And they decided what they decided. And to say that, well, they must have decided 50-50 negligence because the judge uttered the word malingering, I don't see the connection. And I don't think that the jury, I think it's speculative to say that the jury reached the decision they did on liability because of that comment by the court. But again, I think it really goes back to whether or not there was a contemporaneous objection, a suggestion, or an opportunity for the judge to correct his remark or to make some curative instruction that would remedy that situation, or if, as Mr. Cederberg has argued today, there was no remedy, if they felt that strongly that this was an incurable faux pas on the part of Judge Stern, then they should have moved for a mistrial and at least made that record as that they were serious and what they were specifically talking about, and that wasn't done.
Mr. Cederberg, can I ask you on this preservation issue that we've had, what was the length of time between the comment and then kind of said at the end of the day they raised the issue?
I think 2 hours, longer than that. I think Dr. Matthews was on the stand for close to 2 hours with direct and cross-examination. My recollection was that she was our last witness of that day. So we went through we really hadn't started our direct examination, got very far. I completed that, the plaintiffs did the cross, and then, you know, it was the end of the day and the jury was excused.
All right. And then one other question. If I remember right, the jury actually found a damages number here, did they not?
Yeah, I think Mr. Cederberg said 73,000. That's probably correct.
So do you know what they asked for? What was the 73 compared to what they asked for? It goes to the question of whether the malingering comment affected the damages. If the jury awarded the exact number they asked for, that may have an impact.
I don't remember the exact number, but I can tell you it was big, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I don't. That doesn't mean that they didn't establish anything close to that in damages.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, first of all, the fact, the argument that the judge's comments were not directed specifically at Ms. Brennan, I think that's disingenuous. The judge is suggesting that plaintiffs lie at times. That's clearly applicable to the plaintiff in the courtroom at that time when the judge makes the comment. The second issue, or the second argument out there with the comments is, oh, well, it went to the damages, not to liability. Well, the thing about credibility is it follows a person around with whatever they say. So if someone lies to us about one thing, we're less likely to believe them about anything. And that's especially important where Ms. Brennan's case was largely based on her saying she had been in this left lane for some time, and Ms. Gorham saying she changed lanes at the last minute. So who the jury believed was very important. The damages number, I believe it was $73,705, that came from the defense expert. He agreed, he approved all of the treatment that amounted to that damage amount. That's where that came from. All the cases cited on contemporaneous objections and not being made contemporaneously, those objections happened after the verdict. Here we objected about an hour and a half after the statement in our first opportunity outside the presence of the chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.